This is The Meaning of Green, Season 3. I'm Vivian Thompson. In Season 1 of The Meaning of Green, my guests and I examined how we've managed to solve or not to solve major environmental problems like acid rain and leaded gasoline. And we applied the policy lessons we had learned to climate change. Season 2 investigated the links between power, freedom, and the environment, and whether those links shed light on the coronavirus's emergence and spread. Season 3's overarching theme is place and the environment. We'll travel to different locations in the United States and around the world, characterize their environmental issues and possible remedies, and explore connections with other places. This podcast is independently produced in Cedar Closet Studios in Charlottesville, Virginia, and has no sponsor. No outside entity influences the content of The Meaning of Green. Before I started The Meaning of Green, I was for 20 years a professor of environmental policy at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. My experience is not just academic, though. I've also been an environmental regulatory official in Virginia and at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. My three published books are about garbage transport, climate change policy in the U.S., Brazil, and Germany, and about who wields power and how when we regulate air pollution. You can find out more about The Meaning of Green and find links for all podcast episodes at the podcast's website, meaningofgreen.com. This episode, Breaking Even with Nature, is the second part of my look at Germany's energy and climate programs. I will highlight some of the forces that underlie and some complications of Germany's energy and climate programs, which are intertwined with the country's reunification in 1990. We'll start at the Berlin Wall, learn about some of the environmental impacts that have followed reunification, come to understand an important program that has advanced renewable energy in Germany, appreciate some of the hurdles Germans face as they seek to reduce greenhouse gas emissions further, and end in a soy field. The title Breaking Even with Nature comes from something Germany's longtime chancellor Angela Merkel is supposed to have said. She's quoted as saying, "Just as we break even with finances, so we must with nature." Germans have a reputation for being fiscally prudent and balancing government budgets. In fact, the same German word, Schuld, means guilt and debt. So, Chancellor Merkel was making a strong statement when she said, "We must break even with nature." Of course, exactly how that translates in practice is open to debate, but it's certainly a neat concept. In the last episode, I spoke of my many personal connections to Germany. My mother's grandfather was originally German. Both my father and my mother's father studied at the same Berlin Conservatory of Music in different eras, of course. The first time I visited Germany was in summer 1989 when I was doing some work connected with my employment at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. One photo shows me holding my baby daughter in front of the Berlin Wall. The wall was erected in 1961 to keep East Germans from fleeing to the West. No one could have predicted that in November 1989, only a few months after my visit to Berlin, the wall would be breached. It's impossible to forget the euphoria in Germany as people of all ages took hammers to the wall and sat on top of it, drinking, singing, and shouting for joy. 25 years later, in October 2014, my husband and I attended a gala celebration at the German Embassy in Washington to mark a quarter century since the wall fell. It was a memorable event that included food specialties from all 16 German states. My husband posed for a photo in front of an old Trabi, that is to say a Trabant, the small car that was common in East Germany. Trabis were cheap and made of plastic. They were cars for the masses, the East German equivalent of a VW bug. The fall of the wall that had encircled West Berlin since 1961 was the most dramatic and widely watched manifestation of the beginning of the end of a divided Germany. But the intra-German border separating the eastern and western portions of the country stretched for roughly 850 miles from the Baltic Sea in the north to the Czech border in the south. The shorthand descriptor wall does not do justice to the complicated barriers built by the East Germans. There was a so-called no-man's land between parallel barriers that marked the borders to East and West Germany. Here is how that no-man's land and those border barriers worked in a town called Hürtensleben, according to a 2018 documentary called The Berlin Wall, How It Worked, produced by Deutsche Welle.
Before Germany was divided, this street simply ran a straight course. Now a concrete barrier cuts across it, blocking any view to the west, the first major obstacle of the fortified border. The no-man's land here is just 40 meters wide, one of the narrowest points along the frontier between East and West Germany. Just 5 meters behind the wall is a deeply anchored alarm fence. Openings have been left in its foundation for the many rabbits living in no-man's land to prevent them from triggering the alarm. 6 soldiers stand guard in the watchtowers around the clock. 2 are at the top. The other 4 are posted in quarters below. In some places, guard dogs are added to the patrol of the area. A tripwire serves as a further alarm. When a person runs into it, a yellow flare is triggered. The death strip is lit up brightly at night. Live ammunition is fired at anyone trying to flee. Past those, another tripwire. When triggered, it fires a red flare to let the border guards know precisely how far an escape attempt has progressed. Concrete barriers are put up only in areas believed to be especially vulnerable. Most places along the inner German border are marked by a fence, 3 meters tall. There are gates where the fence meets the wall. The first few meters on the other side of the barriers are part of East Germany. Only the most reliable soldiers patrol there. Just 100 meters away, automatic firing devices shoot at anyone who hits the tripwire.
East German guards worked in pairs to keep them from trying to escape to the west. One estimate holds that 44,000 guards were needed for all of those watchtowers, fences, and walls. By now you can begin to imagine the buffer zone that lay between the eastern and western borders of Germany. Because no one was allowed into that narrow strip unless they wanted to be shot, wildlife, including those rabbits, pretty much had it all to themselves. And those plants and animals did quite well, including hundreds of rare species. Today, that formerly forbidden zone hosts an extensive nature preserve called the Greenbelt. Other kinds of environmental improvements followed Germany's reunification in 1990. German experts in environmental policy refer to the wall fall effect, which means pollution reductions that occurred after Germany reunified. In 1990, the country's greenhouse gas emissions jumped dramatically, not only because the country was now larger, but also because of the many dirty, uncontrolled emitters in the former East Germany. In the last episode, Some Germans Wake Up Earlier, you learned that Germany's greenhouse gas emissions have dropped by 41% since 1990. Between 1990 and 2000, Germany's greenhouse gas emissions decreased by 17%, in part because of the wall fall effect. Many former East German industries that had been burning coal collapsed once they were no longer state-supported, and the German government enforced strict air pollution controls. Above and beyond the greenhouse gas and pollution reductions achieved by the wall fall effect, since the 1990s, German government authorities have promoted the adoption of renewable energy through various laws, policies, and incentives. From the previous episode, you might recall the term energy transition or Energiewende. Energy transition refers to Germany's ambitions to turn away from fossil fuels and nuclear power toward renewables. The overarching objective is to achieve a society with a long-term, secure, and sustainable energy supply. That ambition has given birth to a host of energy policies. One of the most famous of those policies is the feed-in tariff. The feed-in tariff in Germany has been both wildly successful in jump-starting widespread investment in renewables and criticized for its costs. The feed-in tariff program pays investors who generate electricity via renewable sources and send it back into the electrical grid. So, for example, an individual who put solar panels on their roof could sell electricity into the grid at a rate that was guaranteed for 20 years. They could feed in their solar electricity to the grid for a fee called a tariff. The idea behind offering a purchase rate guaranteed for 20 years is to provide certainty to investors so they'll have confidence they can sell their electricity and recoup the costs of equipment. The electric utilities in Germany have been required to purchase renewably generated power preferentially over fossil fuel sources. In 2011, Ulrich Kelber, then a member of Germany's national parliament, the Bundestag, spoke about the feed-in tariff's effects in a video made by the Center for American Progress.
Now, the feed-in tariff law empowers people and makes us less dependent on the large utilities and their business model. Because the large utilities, they don't spend money to renewables. They want to let their old nuclear power plants, coal power plants, working all the time. And they want to have dependent consumers. And with the feed-in tariff law, every single person, group of persons, small utilities owned by cities and small villages, they can invest into renewable energies knowing that they can have the profit of installing that. And that means that there were a number of small and middle-sized companies coming up with ideas of technology going onto the market. And this market introduction means mass production of the technology. And so the technology becomes cheaper and cheaper, and the jobs were coming to Germany. So showing people that it's worth not only installing a windmill, but even installing a plan to produce windmills, which means to have a framework for 10, 15, 20 years. And this is the only ability to build up an industry which is competitive to other countries. And to have a political consensus about some common points of this framework is important in the parliament. So industries and consumers and producers don't have to think that there will be a dramatic change every 2 or 4 years.
Electricity users incur an extra tax whose revenues help finance the feed-in tariff program. That tax has been controversial because some energy-intensive industries are exempt and because Germans of modest means are hit the hardest by the tax. To reduce costs to consumers, Germany has essentially phased out the feed-in tariff program and now favors more market-driven approaches to stimulate the development of renewable energy. Many observers worry about these changes, which favor big investors over citizen investors. Now, Germany's solar electricity capacity is about half that of the United States, which might not sound like such a big deal, except that Germany's population is 83 million, that of the U.S. is 330 million. Germany is about the size of one U.S. state, Montana. Finally, Germany is far less sunny than the United States. Part of the reason that Germany has pushed to move away from fossil fuels is that the country is quite dependent on imports of oil and natural gas. Recall that the energy transition aims to provide a secure energy supply. In the first episode of this two-part story, Luisa Neubauer, a prominent climate change activist, specifically criticized the new natural gas pipeline from Russia to Germany that is under construction. But that same energy insecurity helps explain why some Germans argue that they must continue to exploit their coal reserves. Germany has a lot of so-called brown coal or lignite that is mined in vast surface mines. Coal continues to fuel about a quarter of Germany's electricity generation. Plans to cease coal use by 2038 have run into a buzzsaw of criticism because many Germans think it's far too late to phase coal out. Here is a Sky News piece with reporter Adam Parsons from June 2021 that captures some of that controversy. Immerath was a German village in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia.
Immerath was flattened to allow for the expansion of this massive open-cast coal mine, which supplies a local power station that is one of the most polluting in the whole of Europe. Now, the German government has got a plan to phase out coal, but at the same time, this coal mine has got plans to get even bigger, and that would mean the demolition of more local villages.
This is one of them, Lützerath.
Most residents have sold up and moved, but protesters have come in their place, determined to halt the destruction, and some of them living in trees as they plan how to stop the looming demolition.
We are rich in Germany. We have a high income, high living standards, and we need to start making changes here because we can.
For other protesters, there is inspiration from a German hero, Beethoven. In another of the area's condemned villages, a farm has been turned into an impromptu concert venue, staged to throw a spotlight on the plight of this region. Here are the names of villages that have either gone or which are set to be bulldozed. The man organising this concert is Norbert. He's lived on the farm for his entire life, and the spectre of the mine expansion now haunts him.
When you hear these excavators running and you see the light from the mine, very, very bright light, and no one is here, then it puts a lot of pressure on you.
And there is something discordant here. Germany has pledged to phase out coal by 2038. And yet here is Europe's richest country pummeling communities in pursuit of lignite, the most polluting form of coal. So why do it? RWE told us that abandoning coal power has to happen gradually and insist the destruction can't be stopped.
Lignite mining means advancing through the landscape. And you can't just kind of leave out one space and switch to another one. You would have to open a new mine, and that would not be feasible. And it's got something to do with the law. And this coal exit law says that Garzweiler mine is necessary for the security of supply in Germany beyond 2030.
Emirat's residents were resettled about 7 miles away from the original village. Many villages have been sacrificed for this mine, which will be roughly half the size of the island of Manhattan if it's fully developed. One might imagine that, given Germany's dedication to its energy transition, wind power capacity would continue to increase by leaps and bounds. On the one hand, 20% of electricity generation in Germany came from wind in the first half of 2021. But getting that electricity from the windy north to the more densely populated south and west has proven a challenge because the electrical grid has not been able to handle the amount of wind electricity generated. In fact, at times the electricity generated in the north has gone to neighboring countries whose electricity operators have been paid to shut down their wind power generation so that their grids would not be overwhelmed. Expanding the electrical grid to handle all this wind power has not proven straightforward. A few years ago, my husband and I were bicycling in the countryside outside of Fulda, which lies about an hour's train ride northeast of Frankfurt. When I'm in Germany, I always rent a bicycle. It's easy to get around on the country's extensive system of bicycle paths, which parallel city streets and stretch far into the countryside. On this particular excursion, we saw signs protesting the construction of high-voltage electrical transmission lines that would carry electricity from the north. Germany has 6 times the population density of the lower 48 states in the U.S. and, by extension, much less open space. The national government has attempted to address landowner concerns by, for example, paying people more for access to their land or undergrounding transmission lines. Nonetheless, wind power expansion in Germany has slowed dramatically in the last few years. Opposition to wind power is connected not only with concerns about landscape impact, but with potential impacts on bird populations. German wind turbine operators are experimenting with cameras that slow down the turbines when the cameras detect birds. Apparently, some bird species can more easily detect and evade windmills that are moving very slowly. Bats, those amazing creatures that were highlighted in Season 2's episodes about the pandemic, can be killed by windmills too. This 2019 Deutsche Welle story illustrates the debates about how to balance wind power expansion and bat protection.
A brisk wind is blowing across this field in northern Germany. Wilhelm Wilbert wants to show me where he'd like to set up a wind farm. 8 turbines would be enough to provide energy for a small town. But authorization was denied. The reason? Species conservation.
What happened?
The Goldregenpfeifer is...
According to the German Nature Conservation Agency, the European golden plover is under threat. It's nearly died out in the state of Lower Saxony. The conservation agency believes the plover may return to the area. But there hasn't been a sighting in at least a decade.
A permit was granted for another field just a few hundred meters away. That wind farm generates as much energy as half a nuclear power plant and guarantees good returns for its operators. What's a wind farm like this worth?
I don't really like to talk about money. It spurs envy.
So it's good business.
The wind is so strong at this particular location that it's certainly worth the investment. It's generating decent profits for the people and property owners who have a stake in the operation.
But even greater profits could be made if the turbines could constantly turn. When night falls, however, the bats take to the skies, a rare species that has to be protected. Do you agree it's important to switch off at night for the bats?
Well, it's definitely not good for our business. The turbines have to be switched off for as much as 1,000 hours a year. That means they're standing still about 12% of the time.
Wirbetz thinks conservationists in Germany are taking things a little too far.
You can't protect every bird. You have to protect the species. The focus should not be on individual animals that might fly into a turbine. Lots of birds are killed in traffic, but no one leaves their car parked in the garage as a result.
But if just one breeding pair of a species survives, then surely the birds or bats should be protected in order to protect the species. Or do you see things differently?
An old argument is used to justify protecting the bat, namely that there aren't many of them. But it's been our experience that there are bats in every wind farm, and that every wind farm has to shut down periodically because of bats. In other words, they're so numerous, it's ridiculous to claim every single one has to be protected.
Just the same, especially rare animals are given preferential treatment. Wind farmers dread one in particular.
Bechstein's bats have already cost us three turbines at another location. We weren't permitted to build them because a colony was settled there.
Conflicts like these divide the environmental movement because wind turbine manufacturers and operators consider themselves environmentalists too.
Oddly, my first encounter with Germany's early energy transition efforts came in Brazil in 1986, when I was a young air pollution analyst at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. I'll digress for just a minute to tell you about the project I was working on in Brazil. In 1986, Brazil had just emerged from two decades of a military dictatorship. Along with experts from the US, the UK, and West Germany, I was called upon to help state authorities in the southeastern state of São Paulo deal with an incredibly awful air pollution situation in Cubatão. Cubatão is nestled between majestic coastal mountains hosting rich biodiversity and the port city of Santos. During the 1960s and 70s, under the dictatorship, a host of industries established manufacturing facilities in Cubatão, whose pollution went largely uncontrolled. Cubatão became known as the Valley of Death and the most polluted city in the world. The air pollution was so bad it killed vegetation in those lush forests, creating huge barren strips on the steep hillsides and leading to landslides. In the Valley of Death, living conditions were wretched. Residents suffered a long list of pollution-related health problems. Just to take one small example, the rain was so acidic it burned the skin. Our team stepped into a process of evaluation and pollution control that was already underway and that continued for years thereafter. But in May 1986, the world's eyes were focused not on Cubatão, but on another huge environmental disaster, Chernobyl, which had just happened. The West German member of our Brazil team told us about the strong resistance to nuclear power in West Germany, resistance that predated the meltdown at Chernobyl. Some of the radiation from Chernobyl reached West Germany, where it contaminated fields and livestock. West Germans were told to stay inside and to avoid drinking milk and eating greens. At one point, the state legislature in Bavaria debated whether to deem some powdered milk shipments as radioactive waste. Public resistance to nuclear power in West Germany strengthened after the Chernobyl disaster. No new commercial nuclear power stations were built after 1989, and in the early 2000s, new nuclear power plants were banned. Although some politicians wavered over the nuclear ban, after the Fukushima disaster in 2011, the government shuttered several nuclear power plants and said the other nuclear power plants would close down by 2022. A central part of Germany's struggle to move away from coal has to do with its commitment to rid itself of nuclear power. Germany's experience with its energy transition shines a light on innovative policy strategies like the feed-in tariff, while also showing that moving away from fossil fuels and nuclear power means minimizing the impacts of alternative energy sources. To take one more prominent example, mining for lithium, a vital component of batteries for power storage and for electric and hybrid cars, exacts a huge environmental toll that includes habitat destruction, groundwater contamination, and mind-boggling amounts of water use. Government authorities and companies around the world are investigating but have not yet settled on how best to achieve safely high levels of lithium production and lithium battery recycling. Local residents in places like rural Portugal and in the U.S. state of Nevada greet with skepticism claims that lithium mining can be undertaken with minimal impact on humans and the non-human environment. And even as Germany and other European Union nations move toward renewables, their carbon footprints from some imported products remain high. On that subject, here is environment and energy expert Rebecca Bertram, who is originally from Germany but now lives in Honduras.
2 years ago, you might remember the devastating forest fires in the Amazon. Many governments, especially from Europe, were quick to condemn Brazil's growing deforestation rate. The rate had been increasing rapidly since far-right President Bolsonaro took office in January 2019. Deforestation makes up a staggering 44% of Brazil's total carbon emissions. And what these European governments didn't highlight was that their growing soy imports from Brazil are actually responsible for a large share of this deforestation. In fact, Europe has the biggest carbon footprint per unit of soy worldwide. This is because its soy is coming from newly eroded fields and is being transported over long distances. Most of Brazil's soy exports to the European Union go into feeding livestock and the production of biofuels. The EU has a goal of reaching 14% biofuels in its transport sector by 2030. This goal can only be reached with growing imports of Brazilian soy. Biofuels are often presented as a way to decrease carbon emissions, but in fact, they can have twice the carbon footprint as fossil fuels. This aspect needs to be factored into the European debate around biofuels.
Destruction of Brazil's native forests for the sake of soy agriculture puts me in mind of a remarkable film that you might enjoy. Madalena, by rising filmmaker Magiano Marques, was made in Brazil's state of Mato Grosso do Sul and revolves around the death of a trans woman in a soy plantation. Madalena, spelled M-A-D-A-L-E-N-A, is not violent. In fact, it's quite tranquil. But the film spotlights the tragically widespread oppression and high murder rate of transgendered people in Brazil. This may seem off-topic for this podcast, but the reason I mention Madalena is that Maggiano's camera lingers on the vivid landscape, juxtaposing brilliantly the sheer extent of the flat, monotonous soy fields and the layered beauty of local native forests. You, the viewer, can almost feel the breeze blowing around you and the water coursing over you. Until I watched Madalena, I had not really grasped the extent and local impact of Brazil's soy plantations. Madalena should be available for streaming in January 2022. As I mentioned in the last episode, I'm in the middle of moving, and so the Meaning of Green's episodes are spaced more widely than before. Look for the next episode, Garbage In, Garbage Out, in late December. January's episode is called Beauty and the Beast. African elephants are the beauty in that episode. I'm Vivian Thompson. Thank you for listening to The Meaning of Green, Season 3.